Friedman, he says, Friedman says, for example, I am a liberal in the 19th century sense of that. Friedman also says, I am a radical, because a radical is somebody who goes to the root of the problem. Friedman says, I will go to the root of the problem by sweeping away the things that we've done in the last 50 years. They're all wrong. When the Federal Reserve System celebrated its 50th anniversary, Friedman delivered a paper before the American Economics Association convention in which he said, he began, the Federal Reserve System has now been operating for 50 years. It is apparent that the whole thing was a mistake and the experiment should now be abandoned. But Friedman believes that our problems today do not require government intervention. In fact, most of them, I sometimes suspect that for Friedman, all of our problems turn out to be the results of prior government intervention. And he is tremendously effective at talking people into that position. Friedman, I said, who's afraid of Milton Friedman? I'll tell you who's afraid of Milton Friedman. Any economist who has the nerve to disagree with him. Because Friedman has often been disagreed with in the profession, and where Friedman was making judgments that could be established by the evidence, Friedman has time and again turned out to be right. And economists are becoming more and more reluctant to take him on. He's a fantastic debater. He's a great teacher. Teachers actually interested in students. He did teach exclusively graduate students. He has a marvelously lucid mind, and he is gradually converting the economics profession on many issues. There are very few economists who would say they believe in laissez-faire. That's a very small group. But on specific issues, Friedman has been very successful over the years in whittling away the opposition and getting people to come over and join his side. Well, what I want to do this morning, what I want to try doing is, I want to be Milton Friedman. I want to try to give his position on issues and questions that you raised. In other words, I'm going to give one, maybe two, three short examples, and maybe the first example will be long, the rest will be short. We'll see. Tell you where Friedman stands on certain contemporary issues, and how it is, I want to try to show you how it is possible for a man to argue that government intervention doesn't solve anything. In fact, all problems arise from government intervention. I want to show you how it's possible to believe in laissez-faire. but it'll work most effectively if you raise the problems, and then I tell you what Friedman says. Now, I think I'll be able most of the time to tell you what Friedman has actually said or written on the subject. I may have to do some extrapolating, and I'll warn you if I'm extrapolating on uncertain ground. And if I'm not sure how Friedman would answer this, I'll tell you so, and I'll hazard a guess anyhow. But I will always clearly warn you when I'm giving my own position. And I'll just say in advance, I agree with Milton Friedman 98% of the time. So generally, when I'm speaking, I agree with Friedman. One thing I disagree with on is his definition of freedom. That may be very important. Okay, but now for starters. You know, a lot of people are wandering in. I mean, just 30 seconds rehashing. What I'm trying to do is introduce people today to the thinking of, I think, the most interesting economist in the United States, Milton Friedman. A man who's interesting not only because he's a great intellect, a distinguished scholar, but because he's a firm, vigorous participant in political economy discussion. He's in the thick of the debate over concrete issues, and he's got a position, and his position is laissez-faire works, and nothing else does. Okay, let me just try out, for starters, one issue and tell you what Friedman says about it. It's a problem that a lot of people are worried about today, and it's called the draft, otherwise known as the selective service system. What shall we do about the draft? Very simple, Friedman says, abolish it. Get rid of the draft. And we substitute a volunteer army. Why? Because the draft is discriminatory, it's incompatible with political freedom, it is too costly, and it is totally unnecessary. And Friedman would substitute a volunteer military, except perhaps, he says, in periods of total mobilization like World War II. But when we only need 3 or 4 million people in the armed forces, a volunteer military will work perfectly well. Now, four things. It's discriminatory, it's inconsistent with freedom, it's costly, and it's unnecessary. And if I demonstrated the first three, you'll agree with the last one. It's unnecessary. It's discriminatory, first of all. Only a few people are required to go in, not most. And those few people bear the bulk of the cost of life. The principal way in which the United States today is financing its Vietnam commitment is by placing the bulk of the burden upon a few selected young men, their wives, sweethearts, families, you know. I have no close relatives in Vietnam. Consequently, my share of the burden of the war is a slight increase in taxes, some of it disguised in the form of inflation. But that is far below my pro rata share, what would be my pro rata share, if we took the real total cost of the war and allocated it evenly over the population. So I am a beneficiary of this discriminatory system. The majority of the society has gotten together and said, about 90% of us said, you know what we'll do? We'll grab up a chunk of the population and we'll dump them in there and we'll make them bear the full cost of the war. Now, bear the full cost of the war? Sure. If a guy is pulled out of a $10,000 a year job and sent over to fight in Vietnam, he is bearing a rather large financial cost. But the real measure ought to be this. What would you have to pay him in order to get him to do what you want him to do, namely go into the army, train, go to Vietnam, and fight? If you would have to pay him $20,000 to get him to do that, and you give him $2,000 and send him in, you are taxing him $18,000. And that's the cost of the war. Now, that's obviously highly discriminatory, and a lot of people have noticed it. It is, moreover, inconsistent with freedom. Why should some people be forced into the military? Why should a government ever coerce its citizens? Ideally, Friedman says, government should never coerce its citizens. Government, because government is essentially coercive, Friedman doesn't like governments. But it is unnecessary to coerce anybody if you want. Leave everybody free. Can't we do that? Can't we leave every man free to choose for himself whether he wants a woman to choose for herself, whether she wants to go into the army? Couldn't we? Sure we could, if we raise the price high enough. You know, say the military, we call a penny and say, how many you want? They say, 3 million bodies of a certain quality. All right, so we say, all right, we're ready for enlistments. Nobody comes. Well, we raise the price. Some will come. Not enough. Raise the price higher. And just keep raising the price until we get 3 million volunteers that meet whatever criteria the Army establishes by way of physical and mental fitness. And then what we do is we look at how much this costs. Suppose we had to raise it. A lot of people grossly exaggerate how much we would have to pay. People say, ooh, you couldn't get people going to the Army and risk their lives. Because, you know, for any amount of money, well, this is obviously untrue. People, you know, ride motorcycles over waterfalls, and people serve as policemen and firemen. There are career officers in the Army. Obviously, there is a sum of money that will persuade people to go in. And even when we had no draft, people did volunteer. In fact, people even volunteered going to the Army at a time when they could not be drafted because they wanted to. So there are all kinds of reasons which would cause people to go in. It might be that they don't have any good alternative, you know, that they don't have any other good job that appeals to them. But perhaps it's something like $9,000 a year, let's just say. We could get 3 million men. And so we multiply 9,000 by 3 million, and that's the amount of money that the rest of us now, as taxpayers, are going to have to fork out in order to finance it. Now, you're free. You don't have to pay those taxes. You can join the Army. But everybody, see, is in the same boat. Go in, don't go in. Don't go in, you pay high taxes. Do go in, you get a high wage. Everybody's free to choose for himself. I said, Friedman also says that the draft is costly. The reason that it's costly, more costly than a volunteer army, is because you're putting in, you see, the ideal system would be to get into the army the people who would be willing to go in at the lowest price. And that's what will happen if you bid them in. You know, first, the people who don't have any good alternative will go in. Then the people with slightly better alternative will go in. Finally, what we'll have in the army is all of those people who, of course, meet the army's criteria, who have the lowest valued alternative. And that is the true measure of the cost. If I've got nothing to do for 4 hours this afternoon, and somebody comes up and says, hey, you want to throw rocks, what's the cost to me of throwing rocks. Well, I was going to be bored. I was dreaded this afternoon. I didn't know what I'm going to do. I can't sleep because I slept all night, you know, and I got nothing I want to read, and I'm just sitting around like that. It might actually be that the cost to me of throwing rocks is negative. So I would pay to be able to go out and throw rocks. If someone said, you can't throw rocks unless you pay. So like Tom Sawyer and Whitewater Fence. You know? But this is the idea. If you want to keep something cheap, have it done with those resources whose next best alternative is of low value. I mean, since it's perfectly obvious that the people who go into the army are not the people who systematically chosen on the basis of the low cost to them of going in, we're obviously paying more. Of course, it's concealed. That's the advantage of it. But we are really paying more for a drafted army than we would pay for a volunteer army. But there's a great political advantage in keeping the whole thing concealed. If the taxpayers of this country perhaps knew how much they were hit in the face with how much our Southeast Asian engagement is costing, there might be some shifting among the silent majority. Well, I conclude then, or Friedman concludes, the whole draft is unnecessary. And the people who principally disagree are the people in the Pentagon. And I can understand. The Pentagon likes the idea of having a spigot that they can essentially turn on and turn off without having to go to Congress and secure additional appropriations. Now, if you like a society in which the military can determine foreign policy, then you ought to be in favor of the draft, because the draft helps the military determine foreign policy. Okay, let me just give, yeah. Oh, well, I was through with the draft. Okay, all right, I won't. She wants to discuss his feelings on Social Security. No, that's fine. Well, let me just say, does anybody want to hassle the draft question? I don't want to hassle any of these issues too long, but I've given you Friedman's position, and I will say here, I agree with him 100%. Yeah.
Not the draft question, but what did you say about the Pentagon?
Not much. He does say what I've said about the people in the Pentagon. They don't want to have to go through the normal political process. They're afraid that if they went to Congress and said, hey, you guys are going to have to raise taxes so much so that we can send troops into so-and-so, that Congress would get indignant. But if the Pentagon could just step up the rate of draft fees, they can get away with it. And Friedman is very suspicious of all government agencies, including the Pentagon. Yeah.
A quick question. Did Friedman carry his thinking to the point where he saw these people offering money under a fixed period of time?
No, no, the Army would have to make that very clear to them, because the Army has considerable investment in their training. No, you would have to enlist for a fixed period of time, but you would know that in advance. You would know that when you were going in, you were stuck for 4 years or 3 years or whatever. It's up to the Army to determine that. And the longer the period for which the recruit is stuck, the higher, of course, will have to be the wage. There's a way to accept this agreement.
That business of freedom has been sure banging around a lot. According to Friedman, then, you either are free to join the Army or free not to.
Yeah.
That's right?
Yeah, right.
Well, doesn't that encroach on freedom?
Well, yeah,
in a way, sure.
Anytime a government decides to do something, it almost inevitably, Friedman says, encroaches on the freedom of its citizens. Because in order to do something, a government must acquire resources. Now, the only place it can acquire those resources is from its citizens. And when the government takes some money away from me, it is reducing my freedom. Well, Friedman accepts some of this as necessary. But he's saying at least we ought to leave people as free as we possibly can. We ought to acquire the resources in such a way that people are still free to choose. I feel myself much freer if the government comes to me and says, either you pay these taxes or you go into the military. I'm much freer than if the government comes to me and says, you go into the military. The more options the government leaves the citizen, the freer he is. And Friedman wants the government to leave its citizens absolutely as many options as it can.
I should think that would make for a mediocre army, because the poor, uneducated, who couldn't earn, say, $9,000 a year would be the ones that go in the Army because they're earning more money there. And
that's,
have a poor
that's the decision of the military. The military could set criteria. So the military could say, for example, nobody who doesn't have a high school diploma can get in. But, you know, right now, we're very unhappy at the people. We suspect many of these things. We don't like, the draft is discriminatory and we know it. And so what we do is we do all sorts of fishy things and we set up all kinds of deferments and exceptions and making the whole situation worse. And then we give them rewards afterwards. And we cut down the period of service and we have all these crummy programs. You know, I better be careful what I'm attacking here. But you know, all the different ways. But the Army says that our present system is terribly inefficient and costly. We are getting a lot of dregs right now. Guys who, you know, work all week and then go out and march a little bit on the weekend, and then National Guard and Reserve and all this is not very efficient. Is this way, see, the Army would get itself its professional soldiers, its mercenaries, if you will, and it would decide what criteria they have to meet, and it would hire them for a definite period of time, and it would train them, and then they'd be available, they'd be crackerjack troops available for whatever adventure the Pentagon wanted to engage in, hopefully with consent of the State Department. Yeah?
My thinking was along the same line, I guess. It reminds me of the baseball league. What about your loyalty there? So the Russians come along and offer them higher pay. They're going to shift the size to them in the baseball team if they're in there just for pay.
No, wait a minute. Nobody goes in just for pay. That's just wrong. Nobody would go in just for pay. People would go in because of the pay, the fact that they're looking for adventure, feelings of patriotism, lack of anything good to do, desire to get away from mother, and all these things. Now, I don't believe that the Russians would get a very satisfactory army by setting up recruitment stations on our soil. I think it would be prohibitive. You know, I don't think it's just not true. That,
well,
you know, our officers.
Other things. I mean, what you said before, I mean, it's not as if they're just pure mercenaries.
No, it's the same. You know, that's how colleges secure faculty members. They pay them. We don't draft them. That's how we secure policemen and firemen. We get firemen by paying enough to get as many firemen as we want. We don't assume that, well, then guys will be out there fighting the fire and someone's come along and say, hey, you can make more selling insurance. He'll throw down his hose and run off and sell insurance. Just people do things for a great variety of motives. The nice thing about money is that it's almost infinitely divisible. You know, you can give a little more money. If you haven't got enough people doing something, you can give them a little more money and get more people to do it. Everybody kind of likes money. It's very useful. And, you know, money will buy an awful lot of things. That's the great advantage of money. But to bribe people to do something, if I can use that term bribe, I don't mean it to not. I mean, that's essentially the way we get one another to cooperate with us in this society. We bribe one another. But that doesn't mean that a person is just influenced by money. It says that money influences it, not that money is the only thing that influences it, not that money is the predominant thing that influences it. Wait a minute, what's the exploitation? Well, wait a minute, I fail to see how anybody's being exploited. I feel that the people in the military are currently being exploited. I don't see how you could claim they're being exploited if they volunteered. But they're volunteering to do it. Just like Look, if John Markowski came up here and said, I'll pay a dollar and a quarter an hour to anybody who wants to go fight fires, Dave would go, because he kind of wants to fight a fire. He thinks it's kind of exciting. And he could use a buck and a quarter. Now, if he goes, voluntary, he's not being exploited. I mean, if Dave was out there fighting, somebody said, ooh, that's awfully hard work. Only a dollar and a quarter an hour. The Forest Service is exploiting Dave. I would say, no, the Forest Service would only be exploiting Dave if it came in and said, you don't want to come, but you must. It's your duty. Go or we'll shoot you. To exploit a person, by my definition, is to reduce the alternatives before him. Anytime someone comes along and gives me one additional alternative, he doesn't take any alternatives away from me, he gives me one extra one. By my definition of exploitation, that can't be exploitation. Here's a citizen, 21 years old, who has a certain set of alternatives. They may not be very good ones. You know. He may be black and uneducated and so on. So he may not have many good alternatives before him. And I would wonder who's responsible for this. I suspect there's some exploitation going along here. But now when the Army comes along and says, hey, we'll give you one extra alternative, which you're free to reject, you can go into the Army for $9,000 a year. And he says, hey, I'll take that. I can't see that it makes any sense to say he's being exploited. Even if he were willing to go in for $3,000, the Army's going to say, we'll pay you $3,000. $9,000 sounds pretty good. $3,000, we'd say, ooh, that'd be exploitation wage. But if he chooses it, I can't see that it's exploitation. I don't see that it is any different. I don't see it. How can a guy, you know, but that man isn't, I can't see that that man's exploiting it. You might say, well, that employer is taking advantage of a situation, but this would be, for me, the test of exploitation. Go to the man who is supposedly being exploited and say, here is your alleged exploiter. Would you rather he dropped dead and disappeared from the face of the earth or continue doing what he's doing? If the guy says, I'd rather he continues doing what he's doing, though I wish he would drop dead, because, you know, but I really want him to stay around, then I say he's not being exploited. Because, well, but I think, I'm afraid you're... What's the, yeah.
Third alternative,
and that is you say, I don't think he's dead. I hope he stays alive.
And I
want
to get you more money.
Well, I do that all the time. I wish SMU would give me more money. But I don't think SMU is exploiting me. Now, and of course, most people believe they're being exploited. I mean, who of us really has his talents truly recognized? Huh? I'm not endorsing low wages. I'm not saying that we ought to be satisfied with a society in which some people can't find work for more than a dollar an hour. I'm not satisfied with that kind of a society, at least if they can find no, if there's no additional income available to them. There's something wrong here. But I refuse, I'll jump up and down and I'll scream about it. I refuse to say that the employer who comes along and offers a job for a dollar an hour is engaging in exploitation. If there is exploitation, it is elsewhere in the system. The employer who comes along and hires a guy voluntarily is giving him an additional opportunity.
But did you go to SMU for 4 years and then say you see no wage increase regardless of how much the standard of living and other people increase over 4 years, and you had to stay there for you?
No, I didn't have to.
You would if you were in the Army.
Well, but so what? People do make those kinds of agreements. I have made those kinds of agreements. I have gone to a university and said, I commit myself to stay here for 3 years with the guarantee that no matter how much the price level rises during this first year, I will get no increase. And if the price, that I may get an increase the second year, and I may get an increase the third year, but I don't know. I've accepted that kind of a contract. So you're saying that a four-year contract, people don't like four-year contracts. True. Therefore, you have to pay them more to get them to accept four-year contracts. But at some price, people will accept four-year contracts. Well, you know, Can we make this the last one on the draft? Because somebody asked about Social Security.
Right.
Just
to be real quick, I suggest that the chances of Walter Ruther organizing a volunteer army would be much less than the chances of Walter Ruther organizing a drafting army serving the war.
I feel the same way. Yeah. Well, in any event, I have great respect for Walter Ruther. I have great respect for him. But I don't think that Walter Ruther so much organized the United Automobile Workers as stepped into the situation. Well, because he wasn't really, he was hardly active in the original organizing campaigns, but Ruther was a very talented man, but the situation was right. Yeah. Well, let me deal with the question of Social Security. Who asked that? Somebody. Yeah. Well, Friedman stand on Social Security. Friedman says, the Social Security system of this country is a program of compulsory annuities. Every citizen is required to purchase an annuity. And by the way, a pretty rotten one. If you take the amount that we say the employee contributes plus the amount that, quote, the employer contributes, and really the employee is contributing both amounts because it comes out of your salary, it's a wage cost. And if the employer didn't have to pay that, it would tend to slide over into your take-home pay. But anyway, if you take that amount of money and purchase yourself an annuity, you will get a lot better annuity than you're going to get from Social Security. Now, there are certain additional things tied up with Social Security, life insurance advantages and so on, but still, Friedman says, and he's quite right, nobody disputes this. The government is requiring you to buy a form of insurance, and it's requiring you to buy it from the government. The government is the monopolistic seller of insurance. Now, Friedman says, well, he's unhappy with the government requiring every citizen to purchase insurance. But he admits that a lot of people don't look forward to their old age and so on. And we are a kind of a mushy society, so that if a person reaches age 65 and he's retired and he doesn't have any retirement income, we're all going to feel sorry for him. We won't let him starve. We're going to dig into our pockets and support him. And Friedman says, so we don't want to have to do that. We want him to be like the ant that lays aside while it is day so that when he retires, he's got something. So Friedman says, maybe I can go along with the government's requiring every citizen to purchase an annuity. But I insist the government has no right to make him purchase it from the government. Let the government say you've got to purchase an annuity, but you get it in the free market and get the best deal you can. Now, I have, let me insert an objection that I have here. I think Friedman is deliberate. I've never seen him mention this fact. Maybe he has, but in Capitalism and Freedom, he just glides over what I take to be an important aspect of the Social Security program, namely that it is an income redistribution device. The annuity and the benefits that you derive from Social Security are crummy in relation to what you pay, but they are crummier the richer you are. And if you're very poor, they're pretty good. So this is a way in which the government redistributes income. Now, I happen to believe in redistribution of income through taxation. And so does Friedman, incidentally. But Friedman, by the way, has another. Friedman would say, well, if the government wants to do this, I'm quite sure he would say, if the government wants to do it, let it do it openly and directly. Friedman has argued for a negative income tax. Friedman doesn't like governments to be running around claiming to be doing one thing when in fact they're doing something else. By the way, that is where Goldwater, got this idea that he was against Social Security, and then Goldwater found out that when he was against Social Security, a lot of people were against Goldwater. And so you remember Goldwater backed off on that. Well, I'm not really against Social Security. I just believe we ought to re-examine the system. Which really irritated me. I was wishing in that 64 campaign that Goldwater would stick to his guns and mouth the good old Goldwater line. But I was looking forward to a good debate that year, but By the time election day came around, you could hardly tell Goldwater from Johnson, except that Johnson was promising not to escalate things in Vietnam. Guarantee that you're vigorously against that, to support a negative income tax. A guaranteed annual income, which tells a person, no matter how much money you make or don't make, we will give you a certain minimum amount of income. And if you get, let's say we set it at $3,000. So if you go out and earn $500, we give you $2,500. If you earn $2,500, we give you $500. If you earn $3,000, we give you nothing. Well, that means until your income gets up to $3,000, you have no financial incentive to earn income itself. Friedman prefers the system, and so do most economists, all economists. In fact, I think almost everyone who looks at it prefers a system which provides some incentive to an individual to go out and earn income on his own. So that, you know, like what we'll do is, if you earn $1,000, we will give you a certain percentage of the difference between what you earn. It's kind of like the progressive income tax. The more you make, the higher the rate you pay, but still the more you take home. And with the more you make, when you're below the poverty level, the more you earn for yourself, the smaller the amount the government will give you, but never so small an amount that you have no incentive to earn. I should add this. Friedman wants the negative income tax, but he wants it when and if we abolish all the rest of our welfare programs. I believe he will leave some things like aid to the blind. It's a very, very special category today. The question was, does the amount the government takes in Social Security taxes pay for the benefits that are now being... it does. And the main reason that it does is because the people receiving are and have been for some time a much smaller group than the people giving. Because our population's been growing, labor force has been growing, and consequently it's a rather larger group that is paying the taxes than the group which is receiving the benefits. And some people have said that the Social Security system is not actuarially sound, you know. I don't know. I've never really looked into this carefully. I've never seen an article on the question asserting that the Social Security system was not actuarially sound in a reputable journal. And that doesn't say it isn't so. I mean, it's maybe not a sufficiently interesting question for it to be treated in a reputable journal. But I don't think it makes that much difference. Essentially, what the government is doing is collecting taxes from income-earning people and passing out insurance-like benefits to other people. And as long as the government doesn't go bankrupt, the Social Security system won't go bankrupt. Steve? Okay, I don't... Go ahead. What does he say about inflation? Yeah. Friedman says inflation is always caused by the
government.
The government. Yeah. Basically, inflation is too many dollars chasing too few goods. Who prints the money? The U.S. government. The Treasury and the Federal Reserve System cooperating. It's all very complicated. It's a very complicated procedure. But basically, the government has the power to determine the quantity of money, the quantity of the means of payment that will be available in the stock at any given time. We're within limits. It can't fine-tune too well. But the government can control this well enough. And it chooses not to, just like princes always did. Back in the 18th century, Adam Smith was complaining about princes who clipped the coins. The prince would insist upon his monopoly in the right to mint. No coins could be circulated unless they bore the picture of George. That means everybody has to come into the Royal Mint, or else go through the terrible inconvenience of trying to use bullion or gold dust. That's terribly, terribly inconvenient. Coins are very efficient. Now, what the prince would do when the people brought in their gold and silver is he would clip off a little bit for himself. He kept reducing the weight of the coinage, which was his way. Of course, then he would take that and stick it in his treasury, and he could use it to do what he wanted to do. And that's essentially what the government is doing today. Through the Federal Reserve System, it is creating money, and thereby causing inflation. And what it's doing, it's the government is getting the resources that it wants to get by outbidding you with your money. The Friedman says there's a simple way to solve the problem of inflation. Let the government set on a monetary rule that it will increase the money supply automatically by, he used to say 3%, now he's saying 5% every year, rain or shine, money supply increases 5%. The Treasury can't interfere with that. See, what happens is the government wants to borrow some money. It wants to run a $25 billion deficit in order to finance military engagements in Vietnam. And so it says, well, we got to borrow this money. We don't want to pay a very, very high interest rate. The government goes into the market for loanable funds, and it finds out that people won't loan to the government unless the government pays 7%. The government doesn't want to pay 7%, so it turns to the Federal Reserve System and says, create more money. In effect, the Fed creates the money which is loaned to the federal government. And that increases the money supply, and all these additional dollars simply pull up the price level.
Mm-hmm. What, in your opinion, is going to happen to our nation?
Well, Friedman doesn't think that it's going to continue indefinitely, maybe a little bit inflation, but Friedman argues that from 1958 to 1964, we had no inflation in this country. But in 1964, inflation began again. The government cut taxes and was therefore compelled to go borrow the money to finance its expenditures. And so the Fed cranked up the money-making machine again, and we had inflation. Friedman is very concerned about inflation because of all sorts of effects that it has on an economy. But he doesn't anticipate any accelerating rate of increase in the price level, and I think he anticipates a slowing down of the rate of increase. No. I don't know what you mean by a complete total bust. Well, there's no reason why a depression follows an inflation. A lot of people have the idea that the economy is sort of what goes up must come down. That after every inflation, there's a depression. That's not true. No reason why it should be true. There were reasons at one time why that tended to be true, but those reasons have pretty well disappeared.
If it weren't true, that would mean that the government once again has to gradually slow down this thing by legislation of some sort. And it's not necessarily the government to do all these things. How would it slow it down?
Well, he would have the government set its own house in order. Let the government simply increase the money supply 5% per year and set taxes at a level which will cover anticipated expenditures. And then Friedman says, we will find remarkably little inflation and recession. We'll find far more economic stability than we realize we'll find. Just a second, Paul wants to. Friedman believed that he started with the 3% figure because he believed that real product was increasing at the rate of 3% per year. But for complicated reasons that I don't want to go into, Friedman believes that the proper figure now would be 5%. But I know what you're worried about. If the government increases the money supply 5% per year and real output doesn't increase 5% per year, we will get inflation. Yeah. Your instincts are right. But that 5% figure was chosen as a non-inflationary figure. And I don't want to get into technicalities having to do with idle balances, changes in transaction demand, and all kinds of technical stuff, including definitions of money supply that are involved here. But your insight is correct. But that figure was chosen to avoid the problem you two are worried about. Okay? Friedman concluded a few years ago that the 3% figure was too low, that it would have a deflationary, a dragging impact on the economy. But he does not think that 5% will cause creeping inflation.
Yeah, who are these people now, just of late, who are saying that inflation is now about to be
shut? Who's saying that?
Yes.
Me?
No, I want to know who are these people in relation to the Are these things coming out from the government, or are they bona fide?
There are economists not affiliated with the government who are saying that the inflation is slowing down or going to slow down very shortly and will be checked.
Why?
Why? Because the government is putting the economic system through the ringer by drastically shrinking the money supply, which Friedman says is another mistake. One of Friedman's disciples has compared the Federal Reserve System to a kid, a hot rodder with a new automobile. He gets out on the highway, boy, he floors it, and then it's going too fast and has to jam on the brakes. And he has constructed a sort of a monetary history of the Federal Reserve System, demonstrating that every time the economy started the economy was going nicely and the Fed promptly accelerated, we had an inflation. So the Fed says, whoops, too fast, and it slammed on the brakes, and we had a recession. Tries to demonstrate that every inflation and every recession that we've had since the end of World War, since 1918, has been directly attributable to the stupidity of the Federal Reserve managers. And then he says so that in the 1930s, we rewarded the Fed by giving them a newer, bigger, more powerful automobile.
Too complicated for me.
What do you mean?
It's a little business.
Well, it is. Monetary management is a very complicated subject. It happens to be Friedman's principal specialty, and it is the area in which he has been most successful in persuading the economics profession over the years. After World War II, when Friedman's professional career really began, he was saying things like he's saying now, and people were laughing, and they, you know, say, Milton Friedman, funny little Milton Friedman. And today, he's in the textbooks, and people go still to put a foot on. Of course, he isn't right about everything he says, but it does appear that. Although the majority of economists probably are not persuaded to this view that the government ought to simply increase the money supply 5% every year and do nothing else. Friedman believes in automatic controls. If you're going to have government intervention, make it automatic, so that when something happens, the government intervention automatically comes into play. He doesn't like discretionary controls, partly because he fears the power of government and he fears the power of bureaucrats who have discretion, and partly too because he thinks that the monetary managers don't know 10% of what they think they know. And when they start fine-tuning the economy, you know, and you push it a little when it's slowing down, break it a little when it's speeding up, they wind up aggravating the pattern of boom and bust.
But isn't it true that the government has been responsible for some things that are supposed to have a good effect, both on recession and on inflation, in that the Federal Reserve, the establishment of the Federal Reserve, Social Security, the limitations on purchasing stocks on margin, and a number of things like that, which were supposed to be items that would move us along without too much problem with depression, without too much problem with inflation.
You think they've succeeded?
What?
You think they've done this? They've
no,
had
I
this
don't problem. Know, but these are some of the things
Friedman's,
that they have done with the idea that we could move along a little more smoothly than we have.
Yeah, well, Friedman says these things have all been failures. Social Security wasn't designed with that in mind, so it's a failure on another ground. But selective credit controls, margin controls, Federal Reserve monetary management, these things have been failures. The one thing that's been a success, Friedman agrees, is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the system which has done, I think, more than anything else to eliminate
rapid and serious depressions, that when your money is in a bank and you hear that the bank is unsound or the stock market is tumbling or something, you don't run down and get in line to get your money out, because you know that even if the bank president has been guilty of embezzlement, you'll still get your money. So we've completely eliminated bank runs.
And yet Social Security has been responsible for putting money into the economy.
It's been responsible for taking money out of the economy too, though. So. Leo, you were.
Well, I was wondering about wage retirement enrollment and the student that spoke to
No. Wage and price controls, Friedman insists, are treating the symptoms, not the causes. And they make the situation worse. You cannot, you see, if you impose general wage and price controls across the economy, then you have to come up with a new mechanism to allocate resources and to ration things. We use the price system, rising, falling prices, rising, falling wages, to shove resources in directions that we want them to go and to allocate things that are scarce, to ration out things that are scarce. Now, in World War II, we tried to set up a system of general wage and price controls, general price controls. And we did have to come up with a new allocation system. You couldn't go in and plunk down just your money to get a can of pineapple. You also had to come along with some points. Now, we don't have that in mind. Well, so we cannot impose, unless we want to set up a general rationing system, and a general system of priority permits and all that sort of stuff, really go in for central planning, something like the OPA was trying to do in World War II. If we're not willing to do that, then we can't have general wage and price controls. If we're not going to have general wage and price controls, nobody is really talking about general wage and price controls. If we're just talking about wage and price controls in a few, what we call, crucial industries, then we're being arbitrary and unfair. It just isn't fair to slap down the prices in the steel industry and not do anything about prices in the construction industry. Moreover, if you hold down prices in the steel industry, there's not going to be any more steel available. The steel industry will have to start rationing. Some people won't be able to get their steel. There will be unsatisfied demand, and it's going to go off into the aluminum industry or the plywood industry or the cement industry or I know not where. But it's not going to disappear. If you are successful in holding down some arbitrarily, and I would stress arbitrarily, selected prices, generally we pick those prices that seem to be most spectacular. And Americans operate under the illusion that the price of steel makes the world go round. Or that, you know, if you could hold down the price of steel, then nothing would go up. It's a gross myth, I'm convinced. But if we are successful in holding some down, others are just going to rise that much further. It's a little bit like seesaw, yeah. I'm thinking of a bunch of tanks, you know, all connected by pipes underneath, you know, and you can hold down the level in one. Yeah. Well, you know, these are the things we can't control. It really is, when we had these, you remember when we had these wage price guidelines? Back in 1962, Walter Heller announced that we were now going to have wage price guidelines. Walter Heller had consulted a crystal ball and determined that the average national trend in per man-hour productivity was 3.2% per year. That meant, you know, every worker on average, what does it mean on average, was increasing his productivity 3.2%. So everybody was entitled to a 3.2% wage increase. Well, this is just such balderdash. You know, here you are, say, mining copper at Holden Village, and it's a barely profitable operation. And the workers' productivity, simply because the copper is deeper and deeper down in the earth, is declining. And not because they're goofing off, but because it's the situation. And they say, we get a 3.2% wage increase. You say, if I got to pay you a 3.2% wage increase, I close the mine. That's all. It's a silly, silly notion. But it was a big wand that Walter Heller and his crew waved over the economy and persuaded a lot of people. We were having general price stability, see? That's the trick. Institute wage and price guidelines when we're having price stability. And then you can let your wage and price guidelines take credit for it. Some people say, see, look what happened. Heller announced that the wage and price guidelines were off in 65. And look what happened. Prices just started soaring. We began having inflation. Yeah, you know why Heller announced that we were canceling wage and price controls? Because the price level was starting to rise. He sure discredited Milton Friedman's book. I'm speaking for Milton Friedman, but here again, I'm also speaking for myself. I think wage and price controls applied in times like this it's a device that a group of politicians use to bamboozle the public, to persuade the people that the government is doing something, you know. The government is doing something to make the situation worse, but at least people know our government's doing something.
Quick one, but what about
Paul here.
May we hear the Friedman gospel pertaining to agricultural subsidies and tariffs?
Yes, he's flatly against it all. There's no justification for it.
I thought that we were if I wanted to hear the word.
Agricultural subsidies and tariffs. There is no justification for these. What right take tariffs? What right does the government have, Friedman says, to tell me that if I want to reach an agreement with a Japanese manufacturer of radios, that I will give him something and he will give me something? What right does the government have to step in and say, you can't do that unless you pay us something? It interferes with free exchange.
What about oil subsidies? Oil and gas subsidies?
Same thing. No, wait, are you talking about oil import quotas?
No, I'm talking about the
depletion. Now, that's another question. That's a question of taxation. I never read Friedman on that, but I think I have the mind of Friedman when I would say that to single out the oil industry for a 27.5% depletion allowance is to, well, really cut it, but is to be rather arbitrary, because there are lots of resources subject to the same rule. The rationale behind the depletion allowances here is that this is a wasting resource. And, you know, it's something that isn't going to be there forever, and the government shouldn't tax it as if that income's going to be coming in every year. That was the principal argument behind it. And so we set up similar depletion allowances in all sorts of other industries, though it's scaled down, as the gravel industry gets 5% or something like that. But gee whiz, a model, you know, a gal who models clothes, she's selling a wasting resource, too. In fact, who isn't selling a wasting resource? When I can no longer jump around in front of the classroom, I won't command as much income, see? So the government ought to give me a depletion allowance. Because I'm wasting.
Well, we have a lot of interesting examples in California of wasting resources. They have a big hole, a big canyon, and we're receiving income because people were going to dump there. Well, of course, he was wasting his resources. His hole was being reduced.
The government has established various systems for people who, taxation, when you get into, you know, Friedman has a proposal, a basic proposal on the whole taxation system too. He would sort of flat, eliminate all the loopholes and exemptions and create a flat income tax. Standard proportional rate. A lot of people are opposed to, in other words, he would eliminate the progressive income tax, except insofar as progressivity is created by the existence of standard exemptions. In fact, you could build a system that was progressive from the negative income tax on up to any income level simply by sticking in exemptions.
When is an exemption standard?
I'm not talking about the I'm talking about the exemptions, you know, $600.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but you see, well, all right, but
for one eye and
well, no, okay, well, all right. That isn't. I should jerk out the word standard. By sticking in exemptions, you automatically make a tax progressive. And that's the only progressivity that Friedman wants. When people turn around and say, "Ooh, that's awful. We depend on the rich," you know. We have these rates, these big 70-80% rates, and we need those to get money. Well, anybody who studies tax receipts knows that the government collects very, very little money from those very high rates. What the government does do with those high rates is subsidize large numbers of accountants and lawyers, which is another way. You know, anybody who earns enough income to pay in the 70-80% surtax bracket is smart enough to hire a lawyer and accountant to make sure that he doesn't stay in that category. And there's so many ways on it. So we get this odd phenomenon of millionaires paying no taxes. Now, you see, what we've done here, I believe, I've never heard Friedman say it, but I'll say it, I think Friedman would agree. We have not really, as a public, accepted these high tax rates. We were dubious about them. There have been polls, you know, taking to show that Americans do not approve of the high tax rates that we have set on the rich. So we set them, and then we create exemptions to let people out. And it's a grossly inequitable system as a result. By the way, it's 12, and you won't insult me if you leave now. You would have insulted me if you'd left 5 minutes ago, but I'm not.
Well, with regard to the last point, it is true that about 70% of income producing wealth is owned by less than 1% of the people, only
15% of the income. Woo, real. 70% of the income producing wealth is owned by 1%. Where did you get those figures? You can play with income statistics like crazy, but even Gabriel Kolko doesn't say that. He's a Marxist. That's one of good book, critical of the notion that American wealth is rather equally distributed. I'd recommend Gabriel Kolko's book,